I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we ask the question, is America an empire in decline? Our guest on this edition of the show says yes. His name is Alfred W. McCoy, Fred Harvey Harrington Professor of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and author of such books as The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, CIA Complicity in the Global Drug Trade, A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror, and most recently, In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. Late last month, McCoy penned an article for the website Tom Dispatch entitled, While America Was Sleeping, Waking from a Four-Year Fever Dream to Find Global Power Gone. In that piece, McCoy talks about the ramifications of the Trump presidency, how it has led to an accelerated decline of American primacy, and what it means for the rise of China as the potential new global hegemon on the grand chessboard of geopolitics. Not only does Alfred McCoy make the case that America is an empire in decline, but that the full force of that decline may be felt sooner than we think, say by 2030. We discuss all of that and much more in this fascinating and truly insightful conversation. So without further ado, let's get right to it with Alfred W. McCoy, author of In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power, and the recent article, While America Was Sleeping, Waking from a Four-Year Fever Dream to Find Global Power Gone. Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest I've been wanting to have on for quite some time now, Alfred McCoy, author of such books as In the Shadows of the American Century and the Politics of Heroin, as well as the new article out from Tom Dispatch, While America Was Sleeping, Waking from a Four-Year Fever Dream to Find Global Power Gone. How are you doing today, Professor McCoy?
Well, good, JJ. Thanks for having me on the show.
So I want to talk about this article from Tom Dispatch, but first, you've been doing a great deal as a historian on the topic of America as an empire. And I feel like when I bring the topic of America as empire up to a lot of people, there's still this residual Cold War era knee-jerk reaction where people will say, oh, you're saying words like empire and imperialism. That's commie talk. What do you think the response to that should be? Why should we look at America as an empire and not have that knee-jerk reaction from the Cold War era?
Sure. Let me first of all address the if you will, the reservation about the term in the United States, which is just, it's very peculiar in particular to the U.S. For over a century, the term was loaded. After 1898, when the U.S. Took Puerto Rico and the Philippines, Guam as well, and Hawaii for that matter, the Democrats who were opposed to that policy of expansion branded this imperialism, attacked their Republican opponents, who were the advocates of empire, as imperialists. Then, during the Cold War, the Soviet Union attacked the United States as a successor empire to Great Britain. It used imperialism and imperialists and empire as pejoratives to attack the United States. The United States replied in kind. Ronald Reagan branded the Soviet Union not only as an empire, but famously as the evil empire. And then that meant that throughout the Cold War, the term simply could not be used by American historians or American analysts. The empire and the study of imperialism was virtually written out of the American academic curriculum. At the same time that it was prospering and developing as a powerful analytical tool in Europe studying their own imperial past. But when the Cold War came to an end, and then the United States, starting about 15 years after the end of the Cold War, started to suffer some marked reverses, plunging into Iraq disastrously, Afghanistan, getting mired there. Suddenly, analysts right across the political spectrum in the United States, from some very liberal people to some very conservative people, began using the term empire to try and understand what was happening to the United States. And there's now, I think, a general consensus right across the political spectrum among thoughtful analysts of U.S. global power that the term empire is the most appropriate to apply to the United States. Unfortunately, what's happened is, as a result of this aversion to the term, we're in a situation where the world's most powerful empire, indeed the most powerful empire in the history of the world, bar none, is also its least studied. And that means that Americans don't understand, for the most part, the nature of their global presence, the nature of their global power, and they don't understand how to manage challenges to it and its decline. And the decline is already well underway. And those challenges we're facing are gathering apace. It's the end of American global hegemony. We're no longer the world's sole superpower. And that's a profound change.
What was that?
I said that's a profound change.
I would agree it's a very profound change. And I'm curious, where would you pinpoint this as starting? What is the culpability of previous administrations, even before, say, Donald Trump? Because I think a lot of people will focus on Trump as this downfall point, but I think it begins earlier than that.
Look, governments are complex. National governments are complex, and if you had to measure the quality of any administration and its impact upon its own country, that's a challenge, and no interpretation is definitive. It's more or less insightful, but none can be definitive. And by their very nature, because empires not only have a metropolitan center, but their power reaches beyond their own borders and encompasses, in the case of the U.S. empire, most of the world. And so this is an impossibly complex form of government, and attributing definitively its rise or its decline to a single causal factor or an individual, good heavens, is almost an impossible task. So what you can simply note, is the science of the decline. And, and what makes empires rise and what makes them fall? That's really an interesting intellectual challenge. They're so damn complex. Anyway, so to be more specific, To take a shot in the dark and answer your unanswerable question, you can cite, first of all, long-term institutional factors. No empire is forever. Okay, so every empire, and there have been 200 of them over the last 4,000 years, every empire has a parallel cycle of early rise, fluorescence at the peak of power, and then the inevitable, inexorable decline. So, it's a natural cycle, and we're just going through that. Some empires last a decade or even less. You know, the Nazi Empire lasted about 6-7 years, tops. Others last 1,000 years, like Byzantium. But most tend to go, you know, half century or a century, and we're somewhere in between. So there's a natural inclination for empires to decline. We're also what the British Empire called itself, a self-liquidating concern. It was the nature of U.S. global hegemony to promote democracy and development worldwide. And in succeeding, as much as we did, we're kind of working our way out of a job, because as nations become more prosperous, and as America's share of the global economy drops from roughly about 50% after World War II to maybe something like 20% today and falling fast, that means that our relative global power declines. And as nations become more democratic and they become more assertive of their own destiny, well, they're more resistant to U.S. influence. So in a certain sense, you know, it's the nature of the character of U.S. global dominion that it's going to decline. It's going to work itself out of a job. And then there are every process, whether growth or contraction, requires management. And managers of empires are more or less skilled. And the United States had some particularly inept leaders at its apex, you know, who were caught up in imperial hubris. The George W. Bush administration and the neoconservatives that had this idea that we were going to launch ourselves into the Middle East and reshape the destiny of this major world region, and they did that with the Iraq invasion and the Afghan invasion. Well, that's cost us probably $5 or $6 trillion, and it's not working out. You know, our solution to the war in Afghanistan, if there be a solution, is basically to take our enemy, the Taliban, and negotiate and give them power. You know, we were supposed to defeat and crush and wipe out the Taliban. Instead, our solution is put him in power. That marks a pretty major defeat. And the U.S. Army's own history of the Iraq War puts it down as not only problematic, but as a major defeat for the U.S. Army. So there's no question. And there's another thing, is when the U.S. commits its overwhelming military power, which is one of the attributes of its global presence, to defeating, you know, at best small to mid-sized states, Iraq and Afghanistan, and it doesn't happen, the world takes note that we're not as strong as we look. Yeah, how could I put it? Imperial power is kind of like the Wizard of Oz. It's best to have an illusion, thunder and smoke, and never actually use that power. And we used it and didn't use it well. And the result is, we look like the Wizard of Oz, that little doddering old man behind the curtain. We're not as powerful as we once were, and the world now realizes it. There's an analogy, okay, between, let's say, the George Bush administration on the one hand and Trump administration and their mismanagement of U.S. global power. In the U.K., it was the Suez Crisis of 1956. Winston Churchill's successor as Prime Minister, Sir Anthony Eden, had the idea in the midst of global decolonization, the rise of Arab nationalism, that the smartest thing for the U.K. to do was to get together with the Israelis and the French and invade Egypt and seize the Suez Canal. And that, you know, the Britain was conducting an imperial recession. Its power, its imperial power was fading. But the Suez Canal invasion turned out to be such an outrageous debacle that the world could suddenly see, indeed, the British Empire, the residue of the British Empire, the 30 to 40 nations still under control of Britain, could see that Britain's power was over and decolonization very quickly followed. After that, miserable military operation. The British were, and the French and the Israelis were very skilled. They destroyed the Egyptian Air Force. They smashed the Egyptian tank columns. but Nasser was a powerful force in the Arab world. He countered the British and French by taking some rusting ships and filling them with rocks and concrete and sinking them at the mouth of the canal. and playing diplomacy to force the British and French to withdraw. And after that withdrawal, the International Monetary Fund launched its first bailout, not for the Mexican peso, but for the British pound sterling, because Britain was at the brink of bankruptcy, and it took $1 billion to save the British economy. And that was a signal to the world that Britain Zero was done. Well, the U.S. in Iraq and Afghanistan under under George W. Bush and Donald Trump are pretty much the same thing. And then there's the, and we can talk about that, the misbegotten Trump trade war with China.
I would like to talk about that, but one thing I want to draw attention to is you quote in your article the great journalist H.L. Mencken, who predicted back in 1920 that America had finally come to the point where the plain folks of the land will reach their heart's desire at last, and the White House will be adorned by a downright moron. I guess the question that arises from that for me is, how did we get to this point where the American people helped vote in this Trump figure who said he would drain the swamp, but in a lot of ways he seems like the worst aspects of it?
You know, the rise of Trump, because it's so fresh and we're still sort of reeling from and recovering from Trump's 4 years in office, is something I don't think we fully understand. It's very complex. I mean, there's the level of his populist rhetoric, which is, he's actually, as demagogues go, he's pretty good at the business of demagoguery. But, I mean, from a imperial perspective, where we look at people and leadership in much more cut-and-dried manner, how efficacious are they on the global stage? Trump was pretty much disastrous. I mean, when you think about him, on that show, The Apprentice and The Celebrity Apprentice, he played this brilliant tycoon. And so who better to save America from its financial plight in competition with China than this genius financier? And we now know through assiduous investigation by the New York Times that Trump's businesses, particularly his casinos, mainly went bankrupt. That his supposed entrepreneurial flair was really frittering away a $400 million inheritance that his dad gave him through his father's rather skillful property management. So Trump, and Trump claimed to be, you know, this super smart guy who went to this incredibly competitive Ivy League college, the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Well, according to Trump's own sister, he hired somebody to take his college board exams for him. And one professor at Wharton called Donald Trump the stupidest, you know, expletive deleted student I ever had. So, he didn't have the intellect, the education, or the ability to manage the complexity of American society, particularly in a period when its hegemony was being challenged. And I think there's another aspect as well. Our growing economic disparity has not only meant, you know, stagnant incomes for many, but it's also created the aura of the billionaire, the aura of the super rich. You know, people's attitudes towards those with lots of money is mingled resentment and admiration at the same time. And Trump got caught up in that. Moreover, these billionaires, particularly in the Republican Party, you know, have a disproportionate influence in vetting and picking candidates. So, you know, the combination of all of that was we got this monumental mediocrity in the White House. The sign, I think, of actually stupid people is that they actually think they're smart, you know. They don't know enough to know the limits of their own intellect. Everybody's an intellect, no matter how smart, no matter how skilled they might be in any particular field. And Trump is very skilled as an entertainer and as a demagogue. But everybody's talent has its limited, particularly dealing with something as complex as a nation and an empire. And so Trump didn't know his limits. And one of the things he decided almost unilaterally was that he would launch a trade war with China. And he decided that he was going to break the Chinese state. He also decided that multilateral trade agreements and multilateral approaches towards diplomacy was a loser's tactic, that our allies were hoodwinking us and taking advantage of us and bilking us, and so he was going to do this unilaterally, not in concert with our NATO allies, not in concert with our traditional Asian allies, but on our own as a power. And so Trump in 2018 launched this trade war with China, and within about 18 months, it was pretty clear that that trade war was starting to damage the U.S. economy quite seriously. And there's some fairly serious studies of showing, that it was actually doing just that. And he realized that he had to bail out of this in time to have the economy bounce back for the 2020 election. So in January 2020, he signed what he called a big, beautiful trade deal with China, which was actually just a surrender, in which he reduced many of the highest duties that he'd slapped on Chinese imports in exchange for an unenforceable promise from China that they would import large quantities of U.S. goods, many billions of dollars, which they haven't done, by the way. meanwhile, however, China was pursuing a much more subtle multilateral strategy. And what China was doing was actually going back to the Obama administration and, I think, stealing almost a page right out of Obama's strategic playbook. Obama didn't succeed as an imperial manager, as a master of geopolitics, but he understood the world well enough to give it a good try. And Obama had this strategy. Let me wind back. In 2014, China had $4 trillion of income as the world's workshop, as being the world's premier industrial power. $4 trillion in cumulative foreign exchange reserves. And it announced something called the Belt and Road Initiative, in which they would spend over $1 trillion, which is 10 times the size, corrected for inflation, of the Marshall Plan that rebuilt Europe after World War II. And that China would essentially lay down a grid of infrastructure and develop the economies of this tricontinental landmass called the World Island, Europe, Asia, and Africa, and knit them together into a unified economic zone. Obama realized right away that this was a threat, and he came up with a clever two-part strategy to defeat China's bold economic initiative, to defeat the Belt and Road Initiative. And basically what it is Obama came up with a 12-nation Trans-Pacific Partnership, and those 12 nations produce 40% of the world's economy, and that would drain the Asia-Pacific half of China's would-be world island toward America. And then he was negotiating something with Europe called TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Industrial Partnership, and the EU, the European Union, produced about 20% of the world's economy, and that would drain European trade towards America across the Atlantic towards America. In effect, Obama's strategy was to essentially to redirect 60% of world trade towards the United States and turn the Belt and Road Initiative into virtually a hollow shell. And as soon as Trump got into office, he canceled those two multilateral initiatives, he went on this trade war strategy. Well, what China did right after Trump signed that trade agreement in January 2020 was that they essentially, followed Obama's strategy. In November of last year, they concluded a trade agreement, a free trade agreement with 15 nations that encompass 2.2 billion people and account for about 30% of world trade. And then in December, they concluded a financial services agreement with the European Union that gives European banks freer access to China's economy and effectively binds Europe closer to China. And so China, by doing this, now has preferential access to over half of world trade and has integrated the Eurasian landmass, this vast epicenter of the global economy, under its control. And China's inclusion means potentially America's exclusion. So long term, Trump's strategy accelerated China's hold. And that acceleration has become manifest by another aspect of Trump's policy, his gross mismanagement of the COVID-19 pandemic. The epidemic clearly started in Wuhan in China itself. China reacted very quickly after some weeks of denial and dithering of the sort that you expect in an authoritarian state. But once they realized the epidemic was serious, they mobilized enormous resources of the sort of thing you can do in an authoritarian state. And, they wound up with just 80,000 infections and 4,600 deaths. 80,000 infections and 4,600 deaths for a nation of 1.4 billion people. In the United States, Trump dithered. He misled the country, refused to wear masks, used the White House press briefings of the COVID task force to propagate all sorts of nonsense. If you sort of inject disinfectant, it might stop COVID. I mean some monumental absurdities. Masks were optional, not necessary, etc. And so by the time Trump left office, we had 24 million infections, and we had 400,000 deaths. Now, China's economy, this is more than just public health policy. China's policy, they started the COVID epidemic in January of 2020. By May, their economy was operating full tilt. They had basically controlled the virus. They have some local outbreaks, but they wiped those out pretty quickly. So their economy bounced right back and got up to 6% GDP, producing about 30% of world economic growth, and putting them on trajectory to become the world's largest economy in the estimate of a British consulting group that does an annual world economic review by 2028, just 7 years from now. Meanwhile, the U.S. economy is reeling from 40 million job losses, and we're a year into the pandemic and no sign of economic recovery. And if Congress does what economists think is necessary, passes basically a $2 trillion bailout, we might get going later this year or next year. Well, that means that China's got a two-year head start on us. So through his bungled trade war and his mismanaged COVID epidemic, Donald Trump, as much as any individual can do, contributed to China's ascent, its acceleration to becoming the world's preeminent economic power, and then all of the geopolitical power and military strength that flows from that to become, in fact, the world's leading power.
Before we close out, I know we only have a few more minutes left. When it comes to the Trump presidency and going forward now into the Biden presidency, what can we say with regards to the decline of, I guess, American primacy? Because I think a lot of people will respond to claims that this primacy is ending by saying, well, we still have the most powerful military in the world. You know, it's not as simple as, you know, China is going to be the new superpower. But you seem to take a much more I think pessimistic perspective. I don't know if I should say pessimistic, but I think you think that the decline can come much faster, correct?
Yeah, let's okay. China spends about 2% of its gross domestic product on its military. The U.S., it varies, spends about 3%, okay? So, you know, your capacity to develop new weapon systems and new technology is a function of your gross domestic product. By 2030, in what's known as purchasing power equity, what you can actually buy for currency inside your own economy, the spending power of your currency, China's economy by 2030 is estimated to be 40% larger than the U.S. economy. That means that they're going to have about 40% more revenues and resources to use for the development of weapon systems in their military. So inevitably, you know, as China's economy outpaces the U.S. economy, military strength is a function of economic power. China's military will become more powerful than the U.S. military. And already the Pentagon has done, as of a couple of years ago, 18 war games about a military clash in the Taiwan Straits, in which China uses its military force to integrate Taiwan into China. The Pentagon's result, we lost 18 of the 18 war games. Okay, the RAND Corporation in 2015 did a study called War with China. That was 5 years ago, before all of the Trump reverses, all right? Okay, even 5 years ago, the RAND Corporation, which, by the way, is a very influential think tank with a large contract with the Defense Department. It's in many ways, you know, the original think tank, the most influential and the most accurate of them all. And RAND concluded in a war with China that the winner wasn't clear, even back in 2015. Both sides would suffer enormous damage, and it could not be said that the U.S. would be able to defeat China. So, you know, as our economic strength fades, our overwhelming military power will follow in that direction very quickly. And already, you know, let's just look at something. Starting in 1966, 67, the U.S. launched the world's first global telecommunications satellite system, which includes spy satellites for intelligence. The CIA launched some very sophisticated satellites with some brilliant optics. You know, you could supposedly, you know, read a license plate from space, okay? It also became increasingly the satellites became the basis for the three C's: command, control, and communication for the Air Force and for the Army and for the Navy surface fleet, okay? Naval officers no longer navigate by sextant. They use GPS, just like those of us in our cars. Okay, so from 1967 until 2020, the United States had the world's only global telecommunications satellite system. Well, in 2020, China launched the last of its 30-plus satellites. It now has the world's second system. So, you know, it's catching up with us, and you know they're ahead of us in a number of technological areas. So, you know, as economic growth and technological capacity increases, China can surpass us. Another example, okay? You know, there's something called the OECD, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the Rich Countries Club, right? And they run these, every 3 years, they run these tests. And they test hundreds of thousands of 15-year-olds around the world. And in 2012, the kids in Shanghai came number one in math and science. The United States was down in the 20s, you know, in math and science. So we had the, you know, this race to the top, and George W., you know, under Obama and George W. Bush had this massive, you know, investment in U.S. education. At one point, we fell to 39th in math worldwide, and we're now around 30. I think the last PISA test, we're around 36th in math. China's number one. We're 36. So, you know, who cares about a bunch of 15-year-olds with, you know, backpacks, braces, and attitude? Well, you know, within 10 years, those super smart 15-year-olds are your new generation of scientists and engineers. And so, you know, all the signs of China's present performance, the coming generation of super smart Chinese kids, the United States was slipping behind. It's pretty much unstoppable. The question is going to be, you know, what kind of leadership will China have? How will they manage its ascent and its power? Will they make mistakes that will accelerate their decline? That's another question.
Final question, I promise to let you go after this. What does the decline of American primacy portend for Americans? I assume we're going to be turning inward even more so than we already have. I think Trumpism is this sort of turning inward and moving towards xenophobia. And what does it portend for the world as well? What do you see for the future?
Okay, for the United States, look, One of the things we don't realize in the United States is how we've prospered from being the epicenter of the global economy. And the simplest way to grasp it is global reserve currency. The U.S. dollar is the world's global reserve currency. So when we have a fiscal problem, or we have, when we have an economic problem and a public health problem like we do now with COVID, we can just print $2 trillion and hand out the money because the world uses U.S. dollars as their global reserve currency. So we pay very low rates for that debt. We can sell treasury notes to the world because they're so secure. And slowly, the basket of currencies that the IMF uses for international exchanges is shifting. I think in 2015, the head of the IMF announced that the Chinese currency was now part of the basket of currencies. And as America's fiscal situation declines, reflecting its shrinking share of the global economy, and China's increases, China's currency will become an increasingly larger share of the basket. And what does that mean? Well, one of the advantages that America has, okay, is we can pay, you know, miserable wages, $7 an hour, to our workers, right? Because people can buy certain key goods. We can buy clothes very cheaply. Look, America is the shopping capital of the galaxy. You can get more goods for less money in America than anywhere else on the planet. You know, in some countries like Europe, clothes are actually very expensive. For years, people in France would buy one, middle-class people in France would buy one new outfit a season. Americans have closets, baskets full of clothes. And even lower middle class and working class people have lots of clothes. And the other thing is our food is cheap. You know, to buy healthy food is expensive. Organic food is expensive. But you can get basic food in America for relative to our income for less than anywhere else on the planet. That is going to change because food and clothing are global commodities. And as the dollar's competitive position weakens, that means American people are going to have to pay more for essentials. And that is going to really put pressure on the lifestyle of Americans. American life will suddenly become much less present. In terms of what the decline of the U.S. means for the world, it means, in my view, the end of the more positive aspects of U.S. global hegemony. One of the things we did at the start of our power in 1945 is we convened the United Nations, and we wrote a UN charter that decreed equality of all humanity, regardless of race and religion. We made human rights a central facet of U.S. global power. Admittedly, we compromised those principles many times on our own, but nonetheless, those principles remain and they've expanded. China is the first world power to emerge outside the Western rubric. You know, for 500, 600 years, it's been a kind of imperial baton pass from Spain to Holland, from Holland to Britain, Britain to the U.S., and now, for the first time, a power is arising outside this Western intellectual and cultural tradition that has raised human rights to this paramount position. And China, with the way they're treating the Tibetans and the Uyghurs, and the way transnationally they give people like Duterte a free ride for killing, I don't know, last count, 27,000 people in police shootings on the streets of Manila and other major cities, China doesn't care about that any more than they care about their own treatment of the Uyghurs and the Tibetans. And so we will see a decline in the international pressure for the observance of human rights. And I think we'll see a weakening of certain international provisions, more idealistic provisions that are enshrined in the UN Charter. And that I think will be unfortunate.
Will we continue to see this sort of nationalist right-wing populism as well?
That's tricky. Trump's defeat, I think, is a blow. I mean, the United States is a powerful exemplar on the world stage. Trump's ascent legitimated the rhetoric and policies of right-wing populists around the globe. I mean, many of them preceded him. but he legitimated them, and as the United States now, under the Biden administration, resumes the usual liberal internationalist position of the United States, we'll see a weakening of legitimacy. Moreover, I think, you know, the events of January 6th, the attack on the U.S. Capitol by that mob of some 10,000 right-wingers, many of them right-wing militiamen, I think that's had a kind of chilling effect worldwide. I think it's had two effects. One, it's a signal to the world that U.S. is in serious domestic trouble and is no longer reliable as a world leader. It's got domestic problems that need to be addressed. But second, I think it's illustrated the dangers of succumbing to these right-wing populist forces. So we'll see, but it may serve over the longer term to delegitimate the populist right-wing wave that we've seen worldwide.
Well, thank you again, Professor Alfred McCoy, for coming on Parallax Views.
Pleasure to be here, and hopefully we'll talk again sometime.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Alfred W. McCoy, a rather brilliant historian on issues pertaining to geopolitics. I highly recommend checking out all of his work. His books are truly a treasure, especially his latest book, In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Ted, Rats, Martin, Gary, Amelia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15 doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.